All right, looks like we are starting a recording, which I think is a prerequisite for the show.
Who cares really when it comes right down to it?
I'm sure there's a couple of people that care.
I hope so. Anyway, for those of you that do, welcome to the August Mike and Scotty show. And it's amazing to think, Mike, how smooth this procedure has been in the, I don't know, what's it been, about 9 months now since we started this? Or, yeah, it's like January.
Yeah, well, I guess the first one was in December, right? So I think you're right on the month there.
Yep. So it's we're moving right along, and it's amazing, and as we've said before, we love our former co-hosts, but it was just so difficult to make this thing happen on a monthly basis, and now.
The more people you add to any kind of a meeting, the odds of getting everybody to agree on a time goes down exponentially.
Yep. So we're back, and we're in the throes of a summer heat wave, and I'm going to get to your life in general because it's always interesting. But I would just like to point out that there is a little bit of irony going on tonight in that
Really?
I rent a, I guess for lack of a better description, it's a standalone townhouse. The neighborhood that I live in is small houses, really. And the couple that I rent from are fantastic when it comes to keeping the property up and being proactive. And if there's ever a problem, they're right here. And last August, about this time, the gentleman came and he called up and he said, "I want to come and seal the driveway." And I thought, "Okay, great." And it was a Sunday, and came back from my baseball game, and sure enough, he was there sealing the driveway. And as typically is the fashion with him, he was using the absolutely most expensive driveway sealer. I think it had diamond dust in it,
Airport grade.
airport grade. And no sooner had he left when the skies opened up, and I mean, Mike, it rained harder on that afternoon, and all afternoon, all evening, and overnight. And of course, when I woke up in the morning, there was not a speck of driveway sealer left.
That latex stuff is definitely water soluble.
Oh yeah, but what there was these long streams of driveway sealer running down the road, and I thought, boy,
Jeez. It looked
if
like
the
money, didn't it?
yeah, if the condo committee ever saw that, they probably wouldn't be too happy. So. He called me up yesterday, and he was so discouraged. I felt so bad for him. He said, "I'll come back and do it next year." He said, "I can't even face this." So he
You
came.
might want to clue him into that new thing that they've developed called the weather forecast.
Well, and so I don't know necessarily that he's tuned in, but so he came this morning, and again, resealed it with the expensive stuff.
Sure.
And National Weather Service just issued a storm advisory for Western Norfolk County, calling for severe weather until about 10 o'clock tonight. So
So he's batting 1,000.
there is a distinct possibility that we're going to have, as Yogi Berra would say, deja vu all over again.
Well, a couple of years ago, I noticed that my driveway was looking especially bad, and I hadn't maintained it in X amount of time. And with these asphalt driveways, particularly in the Northeast, you either maintain them or at some point you replace them. Those are
Exactly,
kind of
yeah.
the two options. So I knew it would cost me an arm and a leg to replace the driveway, so I thought, I'm going to fix this driveway. So I laid in a supply of that stuff that you melt into the cracks with a propane torch, and spent a very hot July melting all of this stuff into the cracks. And then before the month was over, I started to seal the driveway. Now, there were some areas that I hadn't fixed yet, so I waited. In those areas, I didn't do until, I don't know, maybe September. I didn't think I was going to run into any issues with that timing, but apparently the material you put down is very sensitive to temperature, And somehow I managed to do it in a on a September day where that night the temp got below, I think it was 40 degrees was the cutoff point, and it got to like, 38 degrees or something. And basically it just fell off the driveway, it rinsed off. So I contacted the people who make it and said, I basically sent them some pictures and I said, I'm pretty sure this 10-year warranty driveway stuff is not supposed to come off over the winter. And they agreed. And they looked into it and they looked up the degree days that month. They asked me when I was doing it and they said, yeah, it was probably temperature related. So we're going to arrange with Home Depot where I got the stuff. We're going to send you a coupon that you give to the manager and it's going to be good for, I don't know, it was like 6 or 7 tubs of the stuff, not a small amount.
No.
And we'll give it to you, and you can do it again, right? So last year, I followed the directions slavishly, and did it like in the middle of July, and made sure there wasn't the slightest problem with the surface preparation or the application temperatures at that time. And I was in the driveway was looking great again, and I'm thinking, all right, I'm ready for winter, And wouldn't you know, partway through the winter, it just basically started to fall off the driveway again. So
Wow.
I'm not convinced that it was temperature related at all as the initial problem. There's probably some kind of a surface issue with that area of the driveway. I can't imagine what it would be, but I thought it was spick and span. But I mean, either that or the stuff is just a cruel hoax. And you shouldn't even bother applying it to your driveway. The funny thing is that some areas it's stuck like glue and it's just fine. So clearly, those areas of the driveway where it fell off, I'm kind of done with that area.
Oh God. Well,
Just
that's
how it is.
frustrating. Yeah, it's frustrating. And I know if the skies open up here, that's going to be frustrating too, because like I say, these folks are wonderful. They came in and power washed the siding and scraped the back deck and painted it, and so
It may be dry enough by now, I mean, how many hours has it been down?
probably about five.
That might be enough.
Yeah, they tell you to stay off it for 24 hours.
Well, they don't want you to drive on it, obviously, for
Yeah.
that amount of time.
Yeah.
It may not rinse
Well,
off this time. Let me know.
I
I'll talk
will.
about it on the next podcast.
Hey, before we jump into this, and I know we never really jump into it.
We're already in it. It's too late.
It's like walking into a cold swimming pool, right?
Absolutely. It hits a certain point and you know it.
And I know our listeners know that we tend to be irreverent for probably 90% of the show, but on a serious note, I want to pass along condolences to our former co-host Jimmy Simmons, whose mom passed away a week before last.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
And I will tell you from personal knowledge that Jimmy's mom, Josephine, was one of the nicest ladies I had ever met in my life, and just a true mom in every great sense of the word. Loved her family to death, took care of them like they were little diamonds, which they are, and as well as her husband Jim. And I tell you, I spent a lot of time at their house when I was younger, and they lived in Massachusetts. The dad and I were building a large layout in the basement, which we've talked about on several occasions. And there was not a time that I was ever over there that a hot meal was not put in front of me. So, I am eternally grateful to have known her. And I know, you feel the same way, Mike, but our best wishes go out to the family.
Oh,
And,
absolutely. My condolences. Unfortunately, as we get older here, we need to sort of get good at this kind of thing, which I've never been any good at, but it's I had some guests here last night, post op session, train night, And these are some really nice local older gentlemen who I go to some slideshows when when one of the guys is in town. And they had not been over here. Some of them hadn't been here ever, but one of them comes almost every year, but hadn't come last year, and therefore he hadn't seen all of the changes on the layout. So I told my friend Dave, I said, the day after an op session is a wonderful time to bring somebody over because everything's tested, working, running, clean. There's never a better time to have additional railroad company. So they all came over last night, and I think that other than one guy who's probably about my age, one gent was about 20 years older than me, and a friend of his was even older than that. And
Wow.
all sharp as a tack, and I just thought, boy, that's the kind of old age I certainly plan on needing to have,
Yep.
So it was actually just a very nice time, and they're just very, very nice gentlemen, and it was kind of good to have them here, and I think they got a big kick out of it, because most people that don't have their own layouts or are not in a regular operating crew, they never really get to see a big operating layout. It's something that you see in magazines, but you don't really have much of an opportunity to interact with. So I think they enjoyed it.
I'm sure they did, and I'm very anxious to talk about your op session and the run up to it and the takeaway after it. But I'm going to skip around. I'm going to skip to me first so that we can devote the remainder of the podcast to talking about that. I don't know how you feel about it. I was in the newspaper business. I was a sports writer for a number of years. I've written a bunch of stuff since then, that's been published in one form or another. I've got, including yours, 13 DVDs that I've produced over the years. So I'm kind of used to having my face out there and my name out there as far as the hobby goes. And there isn't a whole lot that phases me anymore. But I have to tell you, I was really looking forward to the August issue of Model Railroader because about a year or so ago, Lou Sasse had come and photographed and interviewed Dick Elwell ostensibly to talk about the new peninsula that he built and I built the paper mill for. Model Railroader is always kind of that benchmark, for better or worse. So,
Been around forever.
been around forever. It's like getting your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone, right? So the magazine came out, and gotta tell you, and nothing against Lou because he's a fantastic writer and a fantastic photographer, but. Well, I was a little disappointed.
So what disappointed you?
That my picture wasn't on the cover. No. First of all, let me take a step back and say that the article was not about me, and I knew that it wasn't about me, and I was certainly okay with that. But Dick and I worked on that peninsula and that paper mill. Over the course of 3 years, the paper mill itself took 2 years to build, from planning to planting.
And included more than one.
And that was right. That's what happens when you have to build two of them. So it was a long pregnancy, and it was a difficult pregnancy. And we both kind of felt the fallout from it afterwards, and to the point where. To the extent that I can, I stepped away from the hobby for a while, and I think Dick kind of threw it into neutral a little bit, and besides the ongoing maintenance that a large layout requires, and regular operating sessions, he wasn't building a whole lot or working at his usual breakneck speed.
You really think it was related to the overall experience?
I think it took a lot out of us. I really do.
Wow. This is supposed to be fun, you know.
Well, I know, but sometimes, as it can also be stressful. And I felt there was a lot riding on this. It was by far the largest structure on the layout. It was in a central location. It was, well, Dick put my name on it, much to my protestations.
Isn't it like the first thing you see when you come down the stairs?
It's the first thing you see when you enter Adams. But yeah, it's certainly the first thing you see when you enter the layout room. And to no one's surprise who knows Dick, he did a magnificent job of making that structure look like it belonged there. He devised a trackage scheme, an operating scheme, a switching scheme that really not only worked and was plausible, but really added something to a model railroad that doesn't need to have anything added to it. And to me, that should have been the focus of the story. The story was, and I know why the story was what it was, because Model Railroader is a magazine now that's for people who are maybe not even in the hobby. It's for people who are in Barnes and Noble and they're walking by the magazine section and they see this interesting cover and they buy it.
Now, are you certain that that Dick, in the interview with them, conveyed it in the way that you thought it should have been?
Well, what he said to me, and I hesitate to speak for him, but I'll pass on the conversation we had because he saw the article before me, and I could tell by the tone of his voice when he told me it was out that he didn't think I was going to like it. And I called him back, and I said, "So, I now understand, the tone of your voice." And he said, "I didn't even want him to write the article." He said, "Because I knew the kind of article he was going to have to write." And he said it, and what it was, Mike, was the typical model railroader article. This is the kind of track work he uses. This is the kind of scenery he built, and it's been done. I mean, Dick's layout's been published, I don't know, 10 times. Everybody knows all these things about Dick's layout. It didn't need to be written about again, but it wouldn't have been published if it had been written any other way.
So was it written like it might have been the first time anybody
Yes.
saw anything about it?
Yep. And Lou touched upon the fact that obviously the layout has been published a number of times, but then kind of, I'm sure he felt, that these were the guidelines.
Well, for better or worse, Model Railroader, and I'm going to probably get some flack for this,
Oh, you and me.
they've always had a reputation for rewriting articles. In other words, you send in, your text, and then it comes out looking kind of like, the corporate model, comeback prose. And that's fine if you know that going in, but it's not really why I would write an article, and it's why I did so many articles for RMC, and why I've done so many articles now for Model Railroad Hobbyist. What I put out there is what comes out.
It's very much a template format. You give an introduction, you talk about the origins, you dive into what the railroad that the layout's based on and how what the benchwork was constructed of. And it's every other article I've ever read in Model Railroader magazine.
Well, playing the straight man here, too bad that's the only article that will ever be written about it, and that'll just be the sum total of the historical record here.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Mike. So I said to Dick, and now, a lot of our conversations these days happen while I'm driving someplace for work because I've got
Bet.
all sorts of windshield time. But
Because that's all you do.
yeah. So I said, look, I said, I need to write an article that really focuses on, what was important about this whole exercise that we did, and that was creating additional operating scenarios.
Now, do you think it's wise to try to write an article while you're driving?
I wrote it, I edited it, I emailed it to a Model Railroad hobbyist, And then I crawled in the back seat and took a nap, all while I was on cruise control.
That's impressive.
So it is impressive.
Well, this new era of driverless cars couldn't have come at a better time for you.
Yeah, there was a movie several years ago called, and I don't know if this is the exact name of it, but have you ever heard of the Darwin Awards?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so there was a movie about Darwin Award winners, and it was based on true stories.
They're usually pretty amusing.
And for those of you who don't know, the Darwin Awards are given out every year to the people who find the most creative ways to die. And you know, they can be some really, really stupid things, like
It always involves something immensely stupid.
this one guy decided he was going to build a car that had a nitric oxide switch,
Ah.
and he was doing about 120 miles an hour on the highway when he flipped the switch, and he immediately went airborne for about a half a mile, and landed hood first into the side of a mountain.
Well,
But
at least he failed to achieve escape velocity, so.
right, exactly. Yeah, he didn't break the bonds of gravity. But the one that hits home here is a couple that had rented a couple from another country who had rented an RV, and the gentleman that rented him was explaining cruise control, and they didn't quite get the full meaning of what cruise control meant. It does not mean auto driving.
Does it include steering?
No, it does not. It does not. They found out the hard way that it does not. So anyway, I'm in the process of writing an article that I will be submitting to Modern Railroad Hobbyist, which will involve a lot more photographs than appeared in Modern Railroad.
How far along are you with that?
I've got a solid outline. And it took me a while. I really, there's no rush for this, but I wanted to start it and get into it while I was still emotional about it, because I tend to do my best writing that way.
Interesting.
And
All we have to do is tick you off and we get maximum output from you.
and again, I think that, this is the type of article that you can certainly publish in Model Railroad Hobbyist, but you can never publish in Model Railroader. It drills down way beyond the typical type of article that you'd expect to read. So I want to do it justice, and I think Dick deserves that effort out of me. And quite frankly, if I'm going to go to the trouble, I might as well do it right, as they say.
Well, in the words of our old friend Bill Schomburg, if you don't like what's in the magazine, write something.
Exactly. So I'll keep you posted on that in the next, I expect to have it done within the next month or so. Work is still crazy, and as we just discussed, I just finished packing my luggage for a 5-day trip to the Azores, which I will be undertaking tomorrow.
I'm very impressed by that. As you may or may not know, at least one set of relatives, and I guess we're going back to probably the late 1800s here, are from the Azores. So that you've now learned the sum total of what I know about all that. Everybody that I could have gotten additional info from is long past, and otherwise, I'd tell you to look up some of my relatives. But I think one side came from the mainland and one side came from the Azores. But I don't know how you feel about seafood, but if you go to the Azores and you don't get an inordinate amount of great fresh seafood, I'm not sure I want to talk to you again.
Well, it's funny what you can do with social media these days, but I actually went on to Facebook and chatted with a couple of restaurants
Really?
in
Well,
San
you are a
Miguel.
planner.
And made reservations,
Guy made
from what I just
reservations in the Azores. That's
made
great.
I made reservations on Facebook chat
Wow.
in the Azores. In fact, I'm looking at one here from Collegio 27, where I will be Thursday night at this time. And
Jeez.
so here's the thing. So now my girlfriend Tina also has ancestors that come from the Azores and specifically San Miguel
Is there anyone there
Island.
that she knows or has
Well,
connected
and
with?
so here's the problem. We spent, as you know, I've spent quite a bit of time on Ancestry.com over the last 3 or 4 years researching my ancestry, because there are certain people that have assured me that I'm not from this planet, and I was
Determined to
hell-bent.
prove
Yeah,
otherwise.
I'm not going to take that. Those are fighting words. So I am from this, as far as I can tell, I am from this planet. But so we did the same with Tina's family, because her dad's father's side comes from the Azores. And here's the problem. For anybody that came to the United States to Ellis Island or the Port of Boston or any of these immigration points, and they were from places like Portugal, Spain, France, Germany, Poland, Russia, Denmark, non-English speaking countries, and you stood in front of the gentleman sitting at the desk, who asked you your name.
They changed it.
If he did not understand what you said and you did not understand English, he would write down anything he wanted because he didn't care.
And that was your name.
And that became your name.
Well, I know that my ancestors were actually named Rosa rather than Rose, which I only found out in modern times because a cousin of mine was doing some of this this kind of investigation.
And under those auspices, this is what happened to Tina's dad's ancestors. They came to the United States and their name got changed, and then it became next to impossible to trace them back to the Azores.
It's
We
why I haven't even tried. My last name isn't Mason, so
Right.
I figured how well can it go?
Yeah, I had it lucky because, obviously the English kept great records.
Yeah, you just went back to the manifest on the Mayflower, and there he was.
There's seven of them. So, we felt kind of bad because it would have been nice to go over there and be able to, either look up some living relatives or at the very least, visit a cemetery or two and pay our respects. But I don't know. I don't even know where you'd begin. And she is not someone who likes to be told that she can't get to the bottom of something. So it's been frustrating, but I'm sure we're gonna have a great time. And folks out there, I can't tell you how many times I have had to tell people exactly where the Azores are. People think it's in the Caribbean or it's in the Pacific, and it's about it.
Azores are to Portugal like Hawaii is to California.
Yeah, exactly. Although maybe not quite as far off the coast, but and so basically in the 1400s, when the Portuguese were at the top of their game and exploring the world, a group of explorers left Portugal and sailed right into the Azores.
Hey, we still know how to get around.
Absolutely, you do. I will give you that. And so they settled the Azores, and it's a part of Portugal now. So I'll report back on how the trip goes. But I want to hear about your month, first of all, because you asked me to ask you how your month and your week went, and then we'll get into the operating session. And I
And
have a
my day.
in your day, yes. So I'm guessing that that this has been a little bit of an unusual period of time for you.
Well, it was a crazy, crazy month, and the whole month consisted of doing stuff that we don't normally do. And it started out with a 2 week visit from my son and his wife, who drove up from Florida, and they hadn't been up here in I think 4 years. I don't think they'd been up here since Karen and my wedding. So it was really nice to see him. I didn't know they were going to be staying for the entire 2 weeks here. So, when you're entertaining for a couple of weeks, it does take you a bit out of your normal routine, naturally. And his wife, Kathy, is a professional chef. So I'm quite positive that I gained at least 5 pounds during the month because this woman can cook, and she's just a sweetheart. So we really enjoyed having the both of them around. It was a little interesting having a cat here because I'm not a a pet person per se, and that was not something that we had discussed much in advance. So I, that that took a little getting used to. But as it turns out, their cat is a really nice cat. I think he thinks he's a dog, and he was kind of cool to have around. But the whole first half of the month really was dominated by this, intense socialization. So we had 1 week off, and then we had the New York contingent arrive, and that's my stepson and his wife, and my stepdaughter, and of course my grandson for the, here for the first time. And they were here for a long weekend, and we just had the best time with the with everybody and the little dude. I mean, he's got potential to be an awesome little kid, and he's awfully cool for an 11-month-old. But I'll tell you what, you finish a 3-day visit with an 11-month-old, and you break out the Windex and you put your feet up for a while, 'cause wow, it was really like getting shot out of a cannon. So,
It's amazing how much energy is required.
oh yeah, you forget. I mean, it all comes back to you. So, I've had Karen in one of those altered states isolation tanks, just kind of processing all of that. And she's probably due
Breathing
out
pure
any
oxygen.
time now. Yeah, she'll eventually be recovered. But it just don't get me wrong. We had a wonderful time, but man, were we beat when we were done with all of that. And it also is an indication of how much stuff you normally do, that because you don't get to, and when you're not doing it, it's like really obvious what you're not doing. I had gone on an installation tear at the very end of June, because instinctively I had a feeling that it was going to be like this. Maybe I underestimated it, but I knew there was going to be an impact. So I looked at that giant backlog of installs, and I said, these have got to go. So I basically just worked my little fingers to the bone getting all these installs done before everybody got here. And it was a good thing, because I think I only did two installs in the month of July, other than that big tear that I went on, because it was just that busy in general. So the instincts were right there. But after everybody left, I looked at the install desk, and it was basically in shambles. I mean, it was just it really looked like something serious had happened there. And I sat down to do my next install, and I said, "Wait a minute. This is just ridiculous. This is it was, I was embarrassed." I looked at my tools, and the fact that every time I needed a tool, I basically had to paw through a 3-inch deep by 1-foot square pile of tools to the immediate right of me, and that's where all of my install tools end up. And I said, this is just the amount of time I'm wasting here. It's just nonsense. So I cleaned all of those tools out of that spot, and I said, all right, that spot is, I don't know what it was, like 10 inches by 15 inches. I said, okay. Went out to the workshop, got a piece of plywood, brought it back in after cutting it to that size. I put the piece of plywood down in that spot, and I organized all of the tools into like six categories. And I piled them neatly on the piece of plywood, drew some lines, went back out to the workshop, and rabbited in some grooves in it, and put in some cross pieces of Masonite, and a surround for the whole thing, and glued it together, brought it back in, put all the tools in it, and I just sat there and looked at it and thought, wow, 5 years of working out of a pile, and in like 40 minutes of effort, I'm going to save myself 40 minutes a day just of time just not going through a pile of tools. It was a little embarrassing.
It's amazing what a little organization can do for you.
I've come to the conclusion that if you do anything more than once, almost any time spent to do it more efficiently is time well spent.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and especially, given all that you've got going down there. You
I can't
know, you.
afford to waste time, you know, and
No, and
that should have
you
been
don't.
obvious years ago. That's my point. You know, you don't realize how much time is passing while you're there scrabbling through this pile of junk when all you had to do was just take under an hour and just look at it and say, how do I make this better? You know, and that really needs to be the approach for me moving forward because I just don't have time to waste.
Well, hopefully moving forward, this speeds up the process and
It already has. It immediately paid huge dividends. And, you know, I just felt like an idiot for not doing it sooner.
well, it's done
Yes.
now. So also, in this time period, because I do pay attention.
Okay, well, you should.
You've spent a good deal of time working on the, for lack of a better term, the Kubota shed,
Oh, you did notice all of that. Yes. Well,
shoring it up and in preparation, I'm assuming for the addition.
all right. So, I can't, I have no idea if we've even spoken about this on prior shows, but the quick and dirty is, I bought a new Kubota. It's got a backhoe. It's the last Kubota I'm ever going to need because the last one was 20 years old when I sold it, and when I got it here, I realized I kind of knew this anyway, but I knew it was going to be inconvenient to take the backhoe off of it every time I was done with it, and you know, be basically assembling the thing every time I wanted to do something with it. So while my son was here, what he and I did was enlarge the front opening so that I could drive the thing in and out without having to remember to lower the rollover protection system, or ROPS as it's called. And we raised all of the rafter ties and made them collar ties, and now I can drive the Kubota in and not tear down the ceiling of the shed, which is I think a positive thing. So the next thing I realized is I need to make the shed deeper, because if I can make it deeper, I can just drive it in and not have to take the backhoe off, and you can see where all that's going. So I was looking at the back wall one day, and I thought, you know, all I have to do really is take out some of these sill bolts that are here, and I took a sledgehammer to it, and it kind of budged. But I thought, boy, it's going to be a lot of work by sledgehammering it. But then, I thought, but I've got a Kubota here, so I got in the tractor and basically eased up to the back wall, put the bucket down low, and just drove until the wall came off.
Okay.
And it really was that simple.
Okay.
So once the wall came off, I thought, cool. I guess there's no point debating the wisdom of this at this point. We're going right ahead. And I proceeded to spend the rest of the month doing some excavating, building all the forms for the concrete pour, and I just basically finished that this weekend. So I think the next thing that'll happen is concrete truck will arrive, pour will happen, and then it'll be time to start building the addition onto the end of the shed
So,
in my spare time.
right, I was going to say, what is the time frame at this point? Do you have a better sense?
Well, realistically, I think I want to be able to close the doors by, you know, by inclement weather time, you know, and that seems like a very, very doable, realistic goal, you know. So that's what I'm shooting for. There are no doors right now, and there's no back on the shed, so it's kind of like a tractor port, if you will.
I bet you're the only one in your development there that has a tractor
Oh, you can count on that.
Porsche. Now, are you friends with your neighbors, or do they think you're weird too?
Yeah, I'm friends with most of my neighbors, and they think I'm weird, but you know, they like me now, despite that. We get along just fine. So I'm not anticipating any problems in that regard.
Now, I'm conducting this interview, so you will comply with my questions.
Aye, mon capitaine.
So, with regards to the basement addition, where does that stand? Last we talked to you, we're waiting for the architect to provide some sort of plan.
Well, I decided that after the kids left, I was going to make it my goal to basically haunt the architect because I wasn't hearing back from him. And like anybody who is good and in demand, they're busy, and the oil goes to the squeaky wheel. So I decided it was time to start squeaking. I don't want to aggravate the guy because, frankly, I need him, and he's a good guy. So I think he's the right guy for the job. But anybody that's decent is definitely not just sitting there waiting for your job to come in. And I knew that going in. So I decided to start making it a priority to make sure he understood that enough time had passed and we needed to get this thing moving along. And I did so, and he's having some difficulties with the roof line. And of course, I reminded him that that was exactly why I brought him into the equation, because I was too. So I just had a conversation with him today, and he has an idea now about how to do it that's going to involve actually making the back wall of it higher, two stories. Which it means I'm going to end up with sort of some attic space in it, which is not a bad thing. And when I said, does that mean it's going to be more expensive as a result? He said, doing it the way I'm picturing, yes, you'll buy some more 2x6s and plywood, but you won't have to buy an expensive LVL beam, and it's probably close to a wash, and you'll get extra space. And I thought, yeah, this guy knows how to talk. But I think he's probably right. Because there's only one solution, right? When you come right down to it, there's only one way you're going to get this thing done. And quite honestly, the longer it goes in, the longer it goes on, rather, the more invested I get in it emotionally. Like I'm already thinking about it like I'm doing it. So I really hope that when the pricing comes in, it isn't so far out in left field that I realize that it's just not feasible. I think that, and I've had extensive conversations with the ops guys about it, and I think that I've thought about it so much that more than anybody, I really am starting to get what a change it will be, what a boon it'll be operationally. Like it'll solve all the goals of getting another railroad involved, in this case the D&H. And the more I research the D&H and the more I run it, the more I love it. It's just a great, really interesting railroad. So being able to add another whole railroad with its myriad power that they were running in my era, and having what will amount to another division, another operational division, and a real interchange that I've been to and visited and understand now. I think it's going to be huge, really. I think it's really going to take everything to another level. So, and the nice thing is, there's a minor amount of kaboom involved in it, but comparatively little compared to what I'm used to. So, it's basically an additive process rather than a rehab, if you will. There's nothing really that I've redone that is scenic that will change at all, and that's a positive thing, I think.
So, have you given a sense of what that space is probably going to look like? Have you had a chance to put pencil to paper and kind of draw in some track work and see how this is all going to work?
Haven't drawn in actual track work, and to be honest with you, all of my experiences doing that have not been as positive as you might think. And maybe that's just how I work or how I think as compared to others, but my experience continues to be that you can do things with pen and paper that you can't do with track. And it's always a rude surprise when you get to the track laying stage. Now, if I was one of these people who love to sit down with these CAD programs and wanted to be that rigid about it, maybe that would be different, you know, but it's just that's not my process for doing this. For me personally, there's been no substitute for the way, okay, so basically the way I look at it is your room is your room. And in this case, I'm building the biggest room that I dare that accomplishes the purpose of joining the two buildings and still allows the driveway to operate correctly, doesn't interfere with the house windows, all these other, you know, criteria. So the footprint is just like when you go down into your basement for the first time. You know, normally you don't make your basement bigger. The footprint is what the footprint is. And then you think about what I do is I think about what is the maximum amount of bench work that I can get in here that allows for the maximum amount of railroading and also allows the humans to interact with this in a way that's conducive to people walking around and being comfortable in it. I think that mistake of making aisles too small is a bad one. And I've been at layouts where the aisle's too small, and you know, the owner always regrets it. You know, it's just one of those compromises you shouldn't make. So if you think about it from a room size and then aisles standpoint, that kind of determines what your bench work needs to be. And it's kind of why, even with all the layout kabooms here, I've hardly had to change bench work because the bench work is kind of what the room permits you to do. So it's your job then to determine what you can do with that bench work footprint to design the layout that you want, you know. So because of all of that, yes, of course I've kind of, you know, done a little bit of sketching to kind of see how the overall flow of the track plan can be, particularly when you're doing something big like this. But for me, there's no substitute in getting some bench work up, throwing some cardboard or plywood down on it, and playing with some track arrangements and seeing what actually works in reality. You know, that's the method that I've had the best luck with.
Well, and I think people forget too that, you can think about track work and how it fits in a space, but there's so many more considerations. There's, as you mentioned, the bench work, but there's, what else beyond the railroad that you're modeling, whether it's industry or cities and towns or neighborhoods or farmland or hills and valleys. But then it's also, aisle space. And, for anybody that has spent any time operating, you know that the appropriate aisle space is critical.
It's gold. I mean, if I had not been running the layout all of this time, I wouldn't have had the benefit of everything that I've learned, both what to do and what not to do, you know. So there's no way I would have been qualified to do something of this kind of undertaking 3 years ago. You know what I mean? I really am able to capitalize on what I've learned over all that time to have a chance of doing this right. One of the things that I'm very interested in doing as part of this is an interchange called DuPont, and it's going to entail some real three-dimensional thought process, the kind of thing you can't really do well with pencil and paper, or at least I can't, because there's going to be, you know, the Lehigh line has a lot of grades. And this last visit that I went to the Lehigh line down there, you know, back in June, I got an understanding of how it all works that I just didn't have prior to that, even though I'd been down there before, because I wasn't really looking at the Lehigh line per se, because everything I was modeling was north of Pittston Junction, which is kind of a water level route. That's why the railroad built it along the river. But everything below Pittston, you know, you're going over Penobscot Mountain, and it's really just a hell of a piece of railroad. So my challenge is going to be to take some existing layout tie-ins and get the grades right so that I can get the flyover that I need for DuPont. And there are several consignees, industries that are basically level sidings that come off of steep grade main line. When I saw this in person, I couldn't believe it. I just thought, wow, this looks like a model railroad. I mean, it really was amazing looking. So
Yep.
I want to be able to capture some of that and have it look right. And that's, I think, the pleasant challenge that I'm going to have with this. I'm actually looking forward to the creative effort to figure out how to do that and have it come out right.
Well, I mean, if anybody can do it, it'll be you. But you brought up a good point, and that's that I think a lot of modelers fail to recognize the importance of, everything that's beside the track work on the prototype, and that's what gives it the distinction of place. And then every good model railroad has it. And without it, you might as well be, I don't, you could be modeling anything. To me, you're no longer a prototype modeler.
Sure.
It's because it's more than the right locomotives and the right cars and the right paint schemes and the right, operating practices. It's also the right scenery and the right structures and, all of that stuff that goes with it. It's just my 2 cents worth.
I don't disagree. It's what makes that aspect of the hobby really interesting to me. And I use the phrase "to me" when I'm talking about this a lot because if that's not what you care about, there's no way you should be caring about what I have to say about it. But if you think of yourself as a prototype modeler and you have any inclination to eventually or sooner than later solving or attacking any of these issues, maybe there's something to be gained from not making a mistake that I've already made.
Well, I think too, Mike, that we're talking to a lot of modelers whose model railroads may not have evolved to the degree that yours has, to the point of completion, I mean. So they may be prototype modelers, but maybe they haven't started to build scenery yet, or maybe they haven't started to operate yet. And so there's a lot of lessons to be learned in all of the things that you've been through. Not only in building a model railroad, but building a model railroad as a prototype modeler.
I often wondered in the past whether there were more layouts being planned than actually existing.
Oh, no doubt. I've got six in my head right now. And I guarantee you I will never build any of them.
You really think that, huh?
Yeah.
That's depressing.
No, look. Been there, done that.
You're not going to build that Penn Central layout? Come on.
Here's the thing, and never say never.
You're not always going to be as busy as you are right now, I know that's hard to picture.
Through the hobby and my profession in the hobby, I've built more model railroads than most. So, there's a certain thrill to the challenge, and like any journey, the first few steps are always the most exciting. With that in mind, certainly it appeals to me, and if the opportunity came about, I would certainly manage the undertaking. And I've learned from great modelers like yourself and Dick and others. About things that I would do differently. But the reality of it is that if I'm here, there's not an opportunity for it. In my next move, there won't be space to do it there either. So, unless I win the lottery and purchase an airplane hangar, which might be the first thing I did, joined a club where I had unending influence and sway over the membership. I can't honestly say that it's in the cards, but that's okay because I've got the opportunity to visit and great model railroads and be friends with great model railroaders and enjoy the hobby greatly. I don't feel like I'm missing anything.
Well, the only thing I will say about all of that, 'cause which is entirely reasonable, it's based on what you know right now. It's based on your current reality, and the thing to remember is, the future really isn't set, and it has a way of surprising you, as you've seen a couple of times. So, I hope I live long enough to see a model railroad builder return to building model railroads, because I think ultimately, a leopard doesn't change his spots. We'll see.
No, and that's ultimately reasonable as well. So the last operating session that you had was, really it was kind of the launch of Apollo 10,
That's
right? I
right.
mean, you were gonna circle the moon, you were gonna separate the lunar module from the command module. Unfortunately it was unmanned, but you were gonna get close enough to the moon to spit on it, but not close enough to land, and all went well with that test run. You found a couple of things, but in general, everything was very positive, as I recall.
Went
And
surprisingly well.
Saturday you had the launch of Apollo 11, and I'm hoping your report is going to say that you did not run out of fuel before you touched down on the surface of the moon, and all was successful. People are out there like, this is the craziest analogy I've ever heard in my
This
life.
is real non-millennial stuff, I gotta tell you.
China? Yeah.
It wasn't even as exciting. I didn't need somebody to be an expert pilot and land with 30 seconds of fuel left. It basically ran wonderfully. We had a somewhat larger group, basically the largest group that I think we've found is feasible, which is seven people, including myself. A friend of mine who had not operated here before, Ken Karlowitz, came up from New York, and the poor guy, I mean, he's not the only guy who has come here from New York for an op session. Chad Rancourt, in the past has come up from New York, and he drives from Schenectady
I
to
remember.
be here for 10. So, that's I'm very flattered by that. It's not something I would do. But I'm flattered that they enjoy it enough to want to do that. And my friend Ken did the same thing. He got up at 5 in the morning and got here, and I think he had a hell of a time. And he was a actually a very good operator. He's got his own small but very impressive D&H layout. And he's got an excellent modeler's eye. In fact, I had him do some building weathering for me, and he did a great job. So it's nice to have people come that are not only simpatico but also compatible abilities and approaches. Basically, everybody that comes can has worked and is welcome to work on my layout. Neil Schofield and Confalone and all these guys, they're all we're all in that same sort of approach, which is real nice. And we had the ability to basically pick up largely where we left off last time, which is something I like to do. That helps out the guys running Mehoopany and Pittston Yard, because usually they leave things sort of documented. And I gotta say, session just ran beautifully. We ran the entire slate. The only thing that was left was a big hazardous coal train to run, and I say hazardous because it was really big, like way bigger than you'd normally want to run during an op session. So when we didn't have time for it, that didn't bother me too much. But it made the perfect demonstration vehicle for the fellows that came over on Monday night, and they get a chance to see a realistic train length train going over the whole layout, and also experience just how long it takes to go over a big layout like that, because It's over 20 minutes if you're doing it right. You actually feel like the train's going somewhere, which has been a kind of a happy result of the latest changes to the layout, So I have to say that everybody had a great time, and we'll likely do it again.
So, at the outset, what, if any, concerns did you have for the session?
Well, this was the first. Well, this was the second session of the new layout, and it was the first one where we were trying to run a full operational slate, and it was the first one that had a somewhat larger group. So, anytime you're introducing variables, unexpected things can happen. But I have to say, the layout just handled it. I mean, it was just no problem. So it makes me think that we've got the right idea, I think. I think we've got the right size group, and we've got the right goals in mind in terms of what we're trying to run during the session, and in the right operational schema. And we've got some variables to throw in so that we're not just doing the same thing every time. But beyond that, I'm probably going to try to do at least one more op session before we get into basement kaboom there with the potential addition. So, for that, what would I change? Not much.
Well, I mean that's fantastic. I would default to your expertise at planning, and I mean there's a reason for everything.
Well, we're not starting entirely from scratch, We're able to capitalize on all of the lessons learned from all of the past sessions, and that knowledge hasn't disappeared, nor is it invalid. So the only thing that became variables were things that were changed because of the layout changes. As it turns out, nothing that you'd have to worry about.
Well, so it was probably the best case scenario.
I have to say, I really have no complaints, and anybody who knows me knows that's not an easy thing for me to say.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a whiner and a complaint. No, I'm only kidding.
Kinda.
No. All right. I think we have shot this horse in the head, chopped it up, and made dog food out of
Well, I hope everybody enjoys
it.
munching on it.
Yeah. Sandwiches for everyone. Mike, I appreciate it as always. It's great to get these updates. And so next month, I will look forward to getting an update from you on the construction process, or at least the beginning of the construction process,
Oh,
and where that all stands. And
absolutely. And you'll be an international traveler once again here, and we'll want to hear about
yeah,
that.
yeah, I will have a report from the Azores, as well as an update on the progress of the new article. So,
And I will tell anybody that was thinking about having some installs done but might have hesitated because of the backlog. The backlog is dead. I'm probably on 2 week rather than 2 month delivery times now. So, if anybody's got something they're waiting on, great time if you're in a hurry.
good news for everyone. Folks, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next month.
See you then.